So we even have pictures this week. All right, well, better get started then.
You'll see it. It is.
It is. It is. It is about Hanukkah. Okay. And it's about the modern state of Israel. Yeah. Okay. No need to be best. Okay. Let me know when we're ready to begin.
Yeah.
Okay. Start anytime. Okay. Great. Morning. Nice to see all of you. With all two of you. Those of you here in person at the OU Center and the thousands watching on Zoom. Okay, we'll get started. With the miraculous return of the Jewish people to their ancestral homeland in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, new questions arose, which for 2,000 years were but the subject of our hopes and dreams. And among them, can a democratic state or government be established in the land of Israel, or must we appoint a king? We have a mitzvah in the Torah, Som Tasim Alecha Melech. Must we appoint a Sanhedrin? What would be the mechanism for this, for appointing a king, for appointing a Sanhedrin? Is it a sine qua non? Are they necessary? And in the absence of a Jewish government, can we create our own army or civilian defense groups, militias? Or must we rely on the secular government to protect us, like the Ottomans, the British, the governing body, those who had control over this land? Do we have to rely on them for protection? So it's fascinating. Following the second Aliyah, which was the major wave of immigration that took place between 1904 and 1914 and saw approximately 35,000 Jews settle here in Israel. We spoke not too long ago about the second Aliyah when we discussed the original Heter Mechira. And you saw, together with this second Aliyah, defense organizations like Bar Giora, HaShomer, Haganah, that were formed to protect the young yeshuv from theft, from violence. Some of these groups would ultimately become some of the defense forces like the Irgun, the Palmach, the Haganah, which ultimately would become the IDF. But if you take a look at the very last page, bottom of page 4, you'll see there a picture. This is a wonderful picture of the defense organization HaShomer from 1909. Okay, look at how they're dressed. It's a fascinating piece of history, this picture here. In fact, one time I spoke on this topic in Har Nof, and someone in the audience said, "Oh, yeah, that's my grandfather over there, second row left." Wow, you know, third from the left. Incredible. Okay. So, but what's interesting was at the time, if you can imagine, there was much opposition by leading rabbis, leading authorities, leading poskim, who questioned if we have the authority to establish these defense organizations, these militias, and defend ourselves, okay? And if we had permission, if it was permitted, if it was mutar, according to Jewish law, to go to war against our enemies without a king, without a Sanhedrin. If you look in the Gemara and the Rambam, you need a king to go to war. You need a Sanhedrin, right? So based on these sources, there were leading authorities who questioned if indeed it was permitted to establish such groups. And so this morning, we'll take a look at a fascinating tshuva from Rav Kook, written in 1916, published in his Mishpat Kohen, where he responds to this very question, and he defends the creation of these Jewish militia groups and Jewish self-defense organizations. And it's an important tshuva. It's a long tshuva, part of a series of tshuvot where he touches on pikuach nefesh and self-defense and self-sacrifice and the rules of engagement in war. It's a tshuva that's or a series of tshuvot, part of a series of tshuvot that are often cited in discussions of questions of halacha and the IDF, military halacha. And what's important for our conversation this morning, in this long tshuva, Rav Kook goes on to justify the creation of a Jewish sovereign state, even without a king, even without a Sanhedrin. And what's fascinating, and this, Rabbi Lev, is the connection to Chanukah, which begins Sunday night, right? What's fascinating is in this very tshuva, Rav Kook will see, uses the Hashmonaim, the Hasmonean dynasty, as a paradigm for the creation of such a sovereign state, for the creation of such a government in the absence of a king, in the absence of a Sanhedrin. But it's not such an obvious choice because, as we'll see, the Hasmonean dynasty, the Hashmonaim, were not so simple. There were all sorts of problems, as we'll see in a moment. But yet, Rav Kook argues that concerning sovereignty, you have to make a distinction between the lichatchila and the bidyeved, the ideal and the post facto, or the, in this case, reality of the situation. Right? You may have some lofty ideals, even in halacha, but then there's the reality on the ground. Now, why might the Hashmonaim not be the best choice to base your argument for the creation of a sovereign state on? Who were the Hashmonaim, really? Yes, they were the heroes of the Hanukkah story. We have songs about them. We speak about them in the Al Hanisim, which we add to the Tefillah and the Birkat HaMazon. But who were they, really? So that's what we'll begin with. If you take a look at source number one, this is the Ramban in his Perush to Parashat Vayechi, Breshit Perek Mem Tet, Genesis chapter 49, where at the end of Sefer Breshit, of course, Yaakov Avinu blesses his children and not only blesses them, but really speaks to their fate and their destiny. And his blessing, or part of his blessing, to the tribe of Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda, is lo yasur shevet mihuda u'mechokek mibein raglav. The scepter shall never depart from Judah, from the tribe of Yehuda, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. We know that for a number of reasons, the tribe of Yehuda gets the malchut, the dynasty, the kingdom, kingship. They become the kings and leaders and rulers of the Jewish people. And then, of course, David HaMelech from the tribe of Judah, following David, his offspring become the rulers of the Jewish people, the kings of the Jewish people, the monarch, Malchut Beit David. And who were the Hashmonaim? Were they from Shevet Yehudah? Were they from the tribe of Judah? Were they from the house of David, the Davidic line, the Davidic dynasty? No, they were Kohanim. They were priests from the tribe of Levi. And so the Ramban here in source number one, in his comments to Breshit Memtet Pasuk Yud, the Ramban is very critical of the Hashmonaim for, in his eyes, usurping the throne, taking the Malchut, the kingdom, the seat of royalty away from the Davidic line, away from the tribe of Judah. Okay? And he writes the following. Okay, again, this is on the pasuk that I just quoted, Lo Yasur Shevet Mihuda, the scepter shall never leave from the tribe of Yehuda. And he writes, Aval Inyano Shelo Yasur Shevet Mihuda El Echad Me'echav, where I've underlined. The matter of the scepter never leaving from the tribe of Yehuda, from among his brothers, Ki Malchut Yisrael HaMoshel Aleihem Mimenu Yeh, because the kingdom of Israel, the kingship, must come from him, comes from the tribe of Yehuda. Velo Yimshol Echad Me'echav Alav. And his brothers, one of his brothers, are not to rule over him. Meaning, the monarchy belongs to the tribe of Judah alone. Okay, and then, as we'll get into shortly, following or later, from the Davidic line, neither of which the Hashmonaim were from. Okay, and so the Ramban, his comments here are lengthy. Just for our purposes this morning, take a look at where I've underlined next. He writes, "V'zehay onesh haChashmonaim." Now here he indicts the Hashmonaim, and he says, because of this, because they usurped the throne, they were punished, and this was their punishment. "V'zehaya onesh haChashmonaim shemalchu bibayit sheni." This is the punishment of the Hashmonaim who ruled during the Second Temple period. "Kiayu chasidei elyon." He writes that at least the original Hashmonaim were righteous individuals, holy people, chasidei elyon. "The ilmalei heim," and without them, "nishtachachu haTorah v'mitzvot miYisrael," the Torah and the mitzvot would have been forgotten from Israel. "The Yevanim," the Syrian Greeks, the Seleucids, made all sorts of decrees against our Torah, against observing certain mitzvot. "V'afalpichen ne'enshu onesh gadol," but nevertheless, right, even though they restored Jewish sovereignty and they prevented the Torah from being forgotten, they were punished, he writes, with a great punishment. "Afalpichen ne'enshu onesh gadol," a great punishment. "Ki arbat b'nei chashmonai hazaken ha'chasidim ha'malchim ze achar ze, im kol gvuratam v'atzlachatam, naflu biyad oyvehem b'charev," b'charev. The four sons of Matityahu, the elder of the Hashmonaim, who ruled one after the other, even with all of their strength and might and success, they fell by the hands of their enemies, by the sword of their enemies. "V'yigi ha'onesh basof, l'ma shamru razal, kol man da'amar mi beit Hashmonai, katina avdahu. And here, the Ramban cites a Gemara in Masechet Bava Batra, Dav Gimel, where he says, and their end was so tragic, ad kidei kach, that he quotes from the Gemara that all who claim to be from the house of the Hashmonaim, all who say, I am from the house of the Hasmoneans, he is a slave. Now, what does that mean? This is a very strange passage in Bava Batra and Daf Gimel about Hordus, King Herod. Now, while our sages may have praised Herod's building abilities and the renovations he made to the Second Temple, which beautified the temple, and he was an obsessive builder. I mean, it was part of his ego. He flattened a mountain in Herodian, edifice complex. I like that. That's cute. Edifice complex. He built Marat HaMachpelah, the whole structure in Hebron around Marat HaMachpelah, and he flattened a mountain, right? Herodian, where the Herodian kings are buried. So our sages, they may have praised his building ability and his building skills and how he beautified the Second Temple, but they didn't view him very fondly. And you'll see from this passage here, which I put in source number 2, we'll read together. It's a very disturbing passage, but it really expresses for the Ramban, the downfall of the Hasmonean dynasty. Now, Herod the Great was a Roman client king of Judea. Not clear whether he really came from the Hasmoneans or not. According to Josephus, he did come from the Hashmonaim, but others will debate that. He was an Idumean, which were a ethnic people from Edom. We have Edom in the Tanakh, of course. The Idumeans were conquered by John Hyrcanus, Hyrcanus, Yochanan Kohen Gadol, between 140 to 130 BCE, and they were forced to observe Jewish law, and many of them converted to Judaism, so it's assumed, and they adopted some Jewish customs and mitzvot and observances, but were not fully integrated into the Jewish people. And while Herod identified as Jewish, it's assumed that he came from the Idumeans, that his father was either an Idumean convert himself or they came from Idumean converts. You see that his pedigree, his yichusin, his story, his origin story is very murky. And that's something that Chazal touched on here. Now, we know that he marries into the Hasmonean family. Whether he was a Hasmonean himself or not is questionable, but he marries into the Hasmonean family. He marries Miriam, or Marianne, Miriam, and later has her executed along with other members of the Hashmonaim. And again, this passage in the Gemara is going to allude to that as well. Okay, so take a look at source number two at the bottom. Hordus avda debet Hashmonai hava. Hordus, Herod, was a slave. According to Chazal, he was a slave in the Hasmonean house. Hava natan enav beotat tinoket. He had his eyes on a certain young maiden, a young lady. Yomachad, one day, Shma Hahu Gavra, this man heard Bat Kala, a heavenly voice issue forth, a Bat Kol, the Amar, which said, Kol Avda demared hashta matzlach. Any slave who rebels now will be successful. Kam katlinhu lechulhu. So he came and he killed them all. Marvate v'shayar lai yanukta, ki chazot hahi yanukta. So he killed them all, but spared this girl, right? But when this girl saw that he wanted to marry her, ki chazot hahi yanukta dekabai leminsva, when he wanted to marry her, slika leigra, she went up to the roof, urama kala, and she went and lifted her voice. She screamed at the top of her lungs, Amara, and said, Kolman da ateva amar mi beit Hashmonai ka'atena avdahu. Anyone who claims to be from the house of the Hasmoneans, you should know that they are nothing but a slave. This is the line that the Ramban quoted, as we just saw. Okay. Dilo ish taira minaihu ela hahi yanukta, because there's no one left except for this young girl, meaning except for me. And what did she do? Vahi yanukta nafla mi'igra la'ara. She jumps off the roof and kills herself. Now, the end of the story is very strange. And here you see Chazal, you know, really trying to stick it to Herod. Tamna shvashinin biduvsha. He preserved her for 7 years in honey. Okay? He preserved her. Tamna shvashi, he preserved her in honey for 7 years. Ikida amri ba'aleha, ikida amri lo ba'aleha. There are those who said that he had his way with her. There are those who said he did not have his way with her. Okay? The amri la ba'aleha, haditamne liyatove liyitzre. Those who say that he had his way with her say the reason why he preserved her in honey for 7 years was in order to satisfy his yetzer, his desire, meaning to be with her post-mortem, okay? And those who say that he was not with her, okay? Why did he preserve her in honey for 7 years? In order that he could say that he married the queen. People did not know that she was deceased. Okay, very strange passage. But from this passage, you see for the Ramban how far the Hasmonean dynasty had fallen, right? And it's not only this. The Ramban continues where I've underlined next. If you go back to source number one, the Ramban writes, the Efshar Gamkein, Shahaya Alehem Chet b'malchutami pnei sheyu kohanim. In addition, he writes that another thing they did wrong, another reason why they were punished and ultimately were no uprooted from the seed of monarchy and were punished in such a way, is because they were Kohanim. And he writes that the Torah warns the Kohanim to preserve. Tishmur et kunatchem. You're supposed to preserve and maintain your priesthood. And he writes that they should not have been kings. That the role of the priest, the role of the Kohen, is to serve Hashem, is to do the Avodah, and not to be a Melech. He writes, "V'lo hayalem limloch, rak lavodet avodat Hashem." Separation of church and state, if you will, religion and government. And then he quotes the Yerushalmi in Horeyot, which says, "Ein moshchin melachim kohanim." We do not anoint kohanim as kings. Okay, so another another thing that they did wrong. Another reason to indict them for the Ramban. So the Ramban doesn't mince any words, doesn't hold back any punches. And in addition to what the Ramban raises, we know that the, again, Chashmonaim were far from simple. They eventually succumbed to the very Hellenism that they fought so hard against. Okay. Eventually there's corruption. They succumb to corruption and scandal and political assassinations. If you take a look at the names of the Chashmonaim kings, the Hasmonean kings, as time goes on, their names become more and more Greek sounding and less Jewish sounding. Okay, that's because they become Hellenized over the time, over time. And it's been suggested that because of this, Chazal intentionally downplay their success. If you look at the passage in the Gemara in Shabbat and Daf Chaf Aleph, which tells the Chanukah story, the famous Brayta of My Chanukah, doesn't speak about the military victory, doesn't speak about the miracle of the battlefield. Instead, it highlights the miracle of the oil. Okay, maybe for this very reason, because the Chashmonim themselves had Hellenized. And if you look in the Mishnah, the Gemara, there are only scant references, po visham, here and there, to Chanukah, to the Chashmonaim. Some cite this as the reason why Chanukah doesn't get its own masechet, its own tractate in the Talmud, because Chazal were critical of the Chashmonaim themselves, how eventually they succumb to the very Hellenism that they fought against initially. So the Chashmonaim are not so simple. We'll just leave it at that. Yet, interestingly, in source number 3, and just for the sake of time, I'll just summarize, but you can take a look at it more in depth. This is the same Ramban, but this is his comments to Bamidbar, Perek Chet, to Parashat Bahalotcha, where Aharon is given this special mitzvah to kindle the lamps of the menorah and have the lamps face the center lamp. Okay, and there, the Ramban writes, you know, there's a famous midrash that's cited by Rashi that after you had the special role of the Nesiim, Aaron feels left out, so to speak, the special gifts of the Nesiim, Aaron feels left out, the Korbanot of the Nesiim. So Aaron is given by Hashem this special mitzvah just for him and his descendants to kindle the menorah, okay? And there the Ramban speaks very glowingly about the descendants of Aaron and how ultimately they restored the light, so to speak, to the Jewish people. And that's why, you know, here, and they, you know, ultimately in the future will kindle the very same menorah that Aharon kindles. And it's supposed to give Aharon a little chizuk. Okay. So here you see the Ramban speaking positively about the Chashmonim. Here in source number 3, there is no mention or criticism of the Chashmonaim by the Ramban. It's just interesting. And the Rambam here in source number 4, in his Hilchot Megillah v'Chanukah, where he discusses the laws of Chanukah and Perek Gimel, first he gives a little history. There as well, he speaks very glowingly of the Chashmonaim, does not mention the fact that they did the wrong thing by usurping the throne. The Rambam, he begins there at the beginning of the third Perek by discussing how during the Second Temple period, the Syrian Greeks, the Seleucids, they decreed all sorts of decrees on the Jewish people against Torah study and preventing them from performing certain mitzvot. And they placed their hand on the Jewish people's money and on their daughters. And they made all sorts of breaches and breached in, and entered into the Holy Temple. And they made things there impure. They made all the pure things impure. Okay. And where I've underlined the Gavru b'nei Chashmonai ha-Kohanim agdolim, and there the Chashmonaim, the great Kohen Gadols, the high priests, they overtook the Greeks, the Hargum, and killed them, the Hoshiu Yisrael miadam, and saved the Jewish people from their hand, the Amidu Melech mina Kohanim, and they appointed a king from the priests, from the Kohanim. No criticism there. The Rambam doesn't say anything. It would sound like it's something positive. V'chazru malchut l'Yisrael yeter al 200 shana ad churban hasheni. And they restored Jewish sovereignty for another 2 centuries, another 200 years, not really 200 years, but in any case, until the Second Temple period. So you had Roman client kings, Roman procurators, but before the Churban. But in any case, the Rambam here makes no fuss about the fact that they appointed themselves king. In fact, just the opposite. He said, "V'hemidu melech min hakohanim." There's no footnote there. There's no asterisk there. And we'll see that for the Rambam, it's not a problem so long as it's only temporary. Yes, the kingdom, the monarchy belongs to the tribe of Judah. Lo yasur shevet miyuda. Yes, it belongs to the Davidic line. But where there's a period of time where there's a shat adachak, or you need a horat shah, where there's a pressing issue that requires the appointment of a king, and you don't have a king from the tribe of Judah, where it's necessary for whatever reason to appoint a king from the Kohanim, maybe because the other Jews had already Hellenized. Okay, and there was tremendous corruption, as we know, during the Second Temple period. So maybe on a temporary basis, you can appoint someone who is not from the tribe of Judah, someone who's not from the Davidic line as king. And that's how the Rambam rules, as we'll see. Okay, in fact, here, if you take a look at page 3 at the top, this is from the Laws of Kings, Hilchot Melachim Perek Aleph, Halacha Chet. Halacha Tet. Okay, Halacha Tet. The Rambam writes, Malchei Beit David, Heim Omdim Le'olam. Okay? Shenemar, Kisachariya, Nachon Adolam. The kings from the tribe of David, they are there forever. But if you appoint a tribe from appoint a king from one of the other tribes, so their rule is not everlasting. It's not forever. Okay, and the Rambam allows for the appointment of a king from one of the other tribes, so long as what as it's not permanent. Okay, and as we'll see in a few moments, for Rav Kook, that is important. You have to make a distinction again between what is ideal and what the reality requires. Ideally, we appoint a king from the tribe of Judah, from the Davidic dynasty. Okay, lo yasur shevet miyuda. But when that's not possible, so you need a king, you need someone to rule, you need a government. And we'll see how Rav Kook bases his whole argument for the justification of the creation of a modern sovereign nation in our ancestral homeland on this very notion. Okay. Also, as we'll see in a moment, Rav Kook will defend the Chashmonaim from the criticisms of the Ramban. And what he'll say is, yeah, okay, maybe they should have, once things got quiet, once things quieted down, once there was peace, they should have restored the throne to the Davidic dynasty. Okay? But them becoming kings or appointing themselves kings, that's not usurping the throne. That's not taking the scepter away of Yehuda. So he modifies. We'll see how the Rav Kook modifies that criticism of the Ramban. We'll see also how Rav Kook bases his argument here in this tshuva on a stira in the Rambam. Now, every good Torah class, every good shir has to have some stira in the Rambam. You have to examine some contradiction or apparent contradiction in the Rambam, where the Rambam lichora contradicts himself. And what's interesting is, if you take a look here at source number 5, okay, at source number 5, Hilchot Malachim Perek Aleph Halacha Gimel, Ein ma'amidin melech batchila ela al pi beitin shel shivim zekenim v'al pi navi. How do you appoint a king? The Rambam writes, you need shivim zekenim, you need a Sanhedrin, and you need a navi. You need a prophet. Okay, that's what the Rambam writes in Perek Aleph, in chapter 1. But then take a look at source number 6. Okay, source number 6. In chapter 5, Perek Hey, Perek Chamishi, what does the Rambam write? Ein ma'amidin melech ela al pi beitin shel shivim ve'echad. You need a Sanhedrin to appoint a king. But what does he leave out there in the fifth chapter in Perek Hey? What does the Rambam leave out? No, he mentions a Sanhedrin. He leaves out the king. In Perek Aleph, he says, in order to appoint a king, you need a Sanhedrin and a Navi, a prophet. A Sanhedrin and a Navi, a prophet. But in Perek Hey, he says, in order to appoint a king, you need a Sanhedrin. Prophets are hard to find these days. Well, that's exactly what Rav Kook is going to say. So Rav Kook is going to reconcile this apparent contradiction, this steer in the Rambam, and is going to say, one is lechatchila, one is bidieved. Yes, if you have a prophet, you appoint a king together with the Sanhedrin along with a prophet. But if the period of prophecy has ended, if you do not have a prophet, so you appoint a king just with the Sanhedrin alone, without a Navi, without a prophet. There's the lechatchila, and then there's the bidiev. There's the ideal, and then there's the reality of the situation. And then Rav Kook, and this is his tremendous chiddush, as we'll see in a moment, and people speak about Rav Kook's creativity in terms of Jewish thought, is his progressiveness and creativity as a Jewish thinker, but he was very creative as a halachist, as a posek, very creative posek. He takes that idea based on the Rambam further. And he says, and what about nowadays when you don't have a Sanhedrin, right? If you had a Sanhedrin and a prophet and Navi, so you appoint the king with a Sanhedrin and a Navi. If you no longer have Navim, so you appoint the king based on just the Sanhedrin alone. But what if you no longer have a Sanhedrin? Okay, now, yes, we've spoken in the past about maybe there are ways to restore a Sanhedrin even nowadays. But without going into that, Rav Kook says, if you don't have a Sanhedrin, you still appoint a king. You still appoint a government. The authority reverts to the Jewish nation. That's what he writes. And this is a tremendous idea. Okay, so take a look at source number 7. We'll go through some of this lengthy tshuva together. It's absolutely fascinating. Now, this was written in 1916 when Rav Kook was in St. Gallen, Switzerland. If you recall, Rav Kook was traveling for a medical procedure and to participate in the Knessia, the conference of Agudat Yisrael, and then World War I breaks out, and he finds himself stranded in Switzerland. He's there, and then he accepts an invitation to be the Rav of Machzike Hadas in England, in London. I've been in the what is today the Brick Lane Mosque, which was, yes, the rabbi went into a mosque, it's okay. Islam, according to the Rambam, is not a Avodah Zarah. You're allowed to go into a mosque, according to many poskim. So, for the sake of research and curiosity, I went into the Brick Lane Mosque, which is the old East End of London, where the Jewish community was in the early 20th century, where they lived. And today it's a lot of Pakistani people there today. It's always gotten different immigrant groups come through. But you see there in the Brick Lane Mosque where the Aron was, clearly where the Aron used to stand. You see where the Ezras Nushim, the women's gallery was. I snuck up to the third floor and saw where the classrooms, the Cheder was. And on the wall, there is still a plaque where the Midrasa is now, where they're educating young Muslims. There is a plaque, a dedication plaque in English and Hebrew. You know, thank you, Mrs. Goldberg and the Goldberg fan, memory of so-and-so, you know, with the Hebrew name, Zecher Nishma, so-and-so. It's incredible. So Rav Kook writes this tshuva in 1916 when he's in St. Gallen, Switzerland. And it's, as I mentioned, part of a series of very important tshuvot on Pikuach Nefesh and self-defense and the right to defend oneself and create an army and create a state and self-sacrifice, Mesirut Nefesh, amazing series of tshuvot, which he writes to a Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Pines, who was a Rav in Switzerland that he was very close with. He had a lot of correspondence. And this Rav Shlomo Zalman Pines himself wrote many Sfarim and was an important figure there in Switzerland. So in any case, Rav Kook writes the following. Umasha katav kvod torato harama, t'imil chamot mimishpat hamluchahein. Again, the initial question, the whole point of departure for Rav Kook in getting into this topic is, can we establish a military? What about these Jewish self-defense groups, these militias like Bar Giora and Hashomer and Haganah? Okay? If fighting is part of the kingdom and kingship and the halachot related to a king. How did the Chashmonaim fight against the Syrian forces before they had a king? Hine al milchama ha-yisodit shel ha-chashmonim shaita b'yichud neged ha-shmad v'shata gzeira shel ha-yevanim. Okay, well, first of all, he writes, they were fighting against an onslaught against our religion. There was a gzeira shmad. They made decrees against our religion. Okay. Lashkicham toratecha ulavira michukei ritzonecha. So that's the first justification. As we say, they wanted to make them forget Torah, and they wanted to prevent them from serving Hashem, as we say in the liturgy. About that, there's nothing to discuss whatsoever. You don't have to defend how they could go to war without a king, right? The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that at a time of Shmad, a person has to give up their life even for a small mitzvah. The Gemara asks, what's a small mitzvah? Changing the shoelace on your shoe. Okay? The different interpretations as to what that means, you know, dressing like them, maybe that's what's so bad about it. Even a small mitzvah, you're supposed to give up your life. So of course they could go to war without a king, right? The eich lo tia reshut, the gam chova litchazek b'milchama. How can you argue there wouldn't be permission? Of course, it's an obligation, just the opposite. There's an obligation to wage war. Kidei levatel et koach hashmaru, lamid et klalot adat al tila. In order to get rid of this decree and to restore religion to its proper place. Okay? Pikuach nefesh. I mean, this is, he's obviously referring to pikuach nefesh as well. It's pikuach nefesh. You know, we have the right to defend ourselves, whether that's here in the holy city of Jerusalem, or a person has to defend themselves and protect themselves, has a right to self-defense, even a place like Kenosha, Wisconsin, if you are up on what's going on in the world. Okay. And certainly if it's to restore Judaism to its proper place. And it continues, it says, what about the following wars? Once things are restored, once they have restored law and order. Shagam ha-malachim ha-ksherim shebehem nilchamu. Az halo kfar hayu malachim umdim al pi haskamat huma. So now he's already touching on our topic this morning. Say, what about once things have calmed down, you find that there are kings now that are fighting, kings that have been appointed through the haskamat ha'uma, the consent of the nation. Now for Rav Kook, that is a key word or key expression, consent of the nation. And this is a theme throughout the thought of Rav Kook, the power, the tremendous power that the umma, HaKlalit, the nation of the Jewish people has. And it justifies them appointing a king, as we'll see. Amnam yesh ledayek milashon haRambam. We should be medayek in the language of the Rambam. And this is the stira, the apparent contradiction in the Rambam that I mentioned. The Rambam writes in Perek Aleph, Malachim Halacha Chet. In the first chapter, he writes, "Shekatav Navi Shemid Melech Mishar Shifte Yisrael, Vaya Oto HaMelech Olech B'derech HaTorah, V'mitzvah V'nilcha Melchumot Hashem, Harei Ze Melech." A king that is appointed by the Navi, okay, and who walks in the ways of Torah, he is the king. The kol mitzvot hamelucha nohagot bo. And all the mitzvot in the Torah that apply to the king apply to this individual. Shedafka al pi Navi, who dave melech, because he was appointed by a prophet. Velo al pi haskamat ha'uma, velo Navi. And he wasn't just appointed by the consent of the nation, he was appointed by a prophet. Ubizman hachashmonim kfar paska nevoa mikfar. And oh, he already raises Akasha. He says, already by the time of the Chashmonim, there was no longer Nivuah. It was no longer the period of prophecy. And so, Rav Kook points out that the Rambam continues in the third halacha and writes, and this is what we saw together. The Rambam writes, you can only appoint a king through a Sanhedrin and a prophet. And the mashma, the implication is that you cannot, that you require both of those. We need both of those things. You need both the Sanhedrin and a prophet. Ela shemidvarav kan balacha gimel hayav shalomar. דלכתחילה היא המצווה בכך. אבל הם העמידו ישראל מלך בלא נביא, גם כן שמדבריו כאן בהלכה ג' היה אפשר לומר, דלכתחילה היא מצווה בכך. אבל אם העמידו ישראל מלך בלא נביא, גם כן הרי זה מלך לכל מצוות המלכות. אוקיי? ובזה היה מקום ליישב הסתירה מפרק ה' סנהדרין הלכה א'. Oh. And there, he says, we're going to reconcile that stira, that contradiction between the Rambam in the first chapter of Hilchot Malachim and the Rambam in the fifth chapter of Hilchot Sanhedrin, where the Rambam writes, "Shekatav ein mamidin melech ela al pi beitin shel 71 velo hiskir navi." There, the Rambam says, you appoint a king through the Sanhedrin, and the Rambam in the fifth chapter of Hilchot Sanhedrin leaves out mention of a navi, of a prophet. Mishum de bidiavad harei ze melech. B'dieved, he is still the king. So the way Rav Kook is trying to reconcile this apparent contradiction, how in one place the Rambam writes, you need both a Sanhedrin and a king to appoint, Sanhedrin and a prophet, a Navi, to appoint a king. And in another place the Rambam writes, you need a Sanhedrin, just the Sanhedrin, and leaves off the king. Rav Kook says, one is Lechadchila, one is B'dieved. Leaves off the prophet. I'm confused here. Thank you. Thank you. Again, in one place, the Rambam writes that you need a Sanhedrin and a prophet. In another place, in the fifth chapter of Hilchot Sanhedrin, the Rambam writes you just need a Sanhedrin to appoint a king and leaves off a prophet. Okay? And Rav Kook reconciles that apparent contradiction by saying that what? One is Lechadchila, one is B'dieved. If you don't have a prophet, like in the days of the Hashmonaim, so you just appoint a king by the Sanhedrin. Okay? Mishum de b'diavad harizmel. B'diavad, post facto, he is the king. Aval ba'alach ha'ched, tilchot malachim kan, shekatav lashon b'diavad. Navi she'emid. We'll skip there till where I've underlined next. Okay? And he writes, v'zeh haya inyan malchut beit chashmonai. And that is the matter concerning the chashmonim. Here he comes to the defense of the chashmonim. U'ma shekatav ha'ramban. This is what the Ramban writes. She'asu shelo karui. Look at how Rav Kook formulates the criticism of the Ramban. See, the Ramban criticizes them for usurping the throne, but Rav Kook modifies it ever so slightly. He says, and this is where the Ramban criticizes them for not returning or restoring the throne, the monarchy, to Malchut Beit David once things were quiet. Okay, that's how Rav Kook slightly modifies the criticism of the Ramban. Certainly they should have tried to do so. So again, he's minimizing the critique of the Ramban. And if there was perhaps some thing that would prevent them, some ha'akava, some mitigating circumstance, because of the kingdom that was ruling on them, whether it was the Greeks or the Romans, maybe according to the Ramban, According to the Ramban, they should have refused the crown to begin with. Aval mikol makom, but nevertheless, kishmenuhu Yisrael b'haskamat Sanhedrin, once the Jewish people, through consent of the Sanhedrin, appointed them, shera'u gam kein, sheish tzorech badavar, they saw that there was a need, v'ulai ra'u shebelo ezratam, shalach hashmonim, shezachu l'tiferet gedola b'umah, mitzad ma'aseyam ha'gdolim, kudushat chasidutam v'toratam hamruba, lo yafshar la'amid melech, just for the sake of time, skip to where I underline next the lines in bold, because this is so essential for Rav Kook. This is so essential for Rav Kook's argument on the validity, really, the validity of the creation of a sovereign nation, of a state, without a Navi, without a Sanhedrin, without a king. Right, aside from all this, it appears, shebizman she'ein melech, at a time when there is no king, like nowadays, right? Since the laws of governance also are related to the situation of the nation, chozrim eila hazchuyot shel hamishpatim liyad ha'uma bichla. This is so important. The zchuyot, the rights, the rights of governance are given over, are restored to the nation. Any judge who arises in Israel has the status of a king concerning governance. Concerning governing the klal, the populace, the nation, the society. And skip to where I've underlined next. He repeats this idea and emphasizes aval lemashin ogel anagat haklal kol manhig kol shamanhig et kol shamanhig et ha'uma danhu b'mishpatei ha'melucha shehem klal tzarchei ha'uma drushim l'shatam ulemamad ha'olam. Again, concerning what is related to governance, any leader has almost the status of a king so long as he is fulfilling the needs at that time. And the nation has the permission to appoint such leaders, whether that means a king or whether that means through a democratic process, electing a prime minister, electing members of Knesset. Okay? This is a fascinating tshuva. By the way, at the same time, you had people like Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who was a Gon Olam, who had to leave Eretz Yisrael because of the Kanaim, the fanatics in Eretz Yisrael, and ends up as the chief rabbi of Union City, Hudson County, Hoboken, Weehawken, Jersey City's areas by the Lincoln Tunnel, okay? And he writes a series of tshuvot called Malki Bakodesh, very influenced by de Tocqueville. He talks about establishing a democracy in the state of Israel. Okay, here, Rav Kook is defending or justifying the validity of a Jewish sovereign nation without the appointment of a Sanhedrin or a Navi, without a king. He says that the rights are given over to the Ummah. Okay? And he brings different examples for this. Just look at the very last line here. I mean, it's part of a longer tshuva, but the very last line that I've excerpted here, he talks about the Reish Galut in Bavel and how leaders we appoint have a certain status. He writes where I've underlined at the very bottom in bold, Aval kishemit mana manhig ha'uma l'kol tzarchei b'signon malchuti al pi dat haklal b'dat beidin, when the nation appoints a leader, okay, to fulfill their needs, to respond to their needs, okay, through the consent of the klal, through the intent, the dat, the mindset of the klal, maybe through a democratic election, vaday omedhu b'makom melech. He certainly stands in the place of the king. L'inyan mishpatei ha'melucha hanogim l'hanhagat haklal. To rule, all the matters of governance apply to him. All the laws that are given over to the king concerning the klal apply to him as well. Now that statement can be understood to mean that modern leaders have the status of a king and maybe the authority of a melech b'Yisrael and can put people to death, right? And have a full authority, complete authority. And this idea has been, I would suggest, corrupted by some in this country. They're known as mamlachtiim, who believe that the prime minister and the members of the Knesset, that today's modern government in the modern state of Israel has the authority of the king. That's what Rav Kook is saying here. Some of the students of Rav Kook, not all, some of the students of Rav Kook took this idea to an extreme. Okay, but you could see how this line really opens up a Pandora's box. How do you understand this line? So some, they refer to them as mamlachtim, say, yeah, the government has complete authority, just like the king. And if you don't listen to them, you are moreid b'malchut. It's as if you are rebelling against the king, which is punishable by the death penalty, according to Jewish law. And that argument reared its head during the Hitnatkut, during the disengagement from Gush Katif, where there were some rabbis, again, followers of the tradition of Rav Kook, who argued you have to listen to the government's decision, even if you disagree with it, okay? Because the government has the status of a king. Now, I don't think that is what Rav Kook meant here. I don't think that is Rav Kook's intention. I think, again, he keeps repeating, yes, they have the status of a king concerning governing the people. He's using this as a justification, again, to appoint a government without a Sanhedrin, without a Navi, without a king. Okay? And he has the status of a king, meaning the Knesset or the prime minister or whomever rules over us, but it's through consent. He keeps reiterating and repeating and going over again this idea of consent. It's someone that we appoint, a government that we appoint, the people appoint through consent. But to say that he has complete authority like the king, that's not consent. Right. But my point is I'm trying to suggest that while these lines are potentially dangerous, it's like opening up a Pandora's box. You have to be careful how you understand these lines. And some have, I believe, taken this to an extreme, the Mamlachti, and say, yeah, we have to accord the government here with the full status of a king. I don't think that's what Rav Kook intended, but I just want to come back to some of the questions that we raised, because it's so fascinating that Rav Kook draws on the Hashmonaim here to justify the establishment of a Jewish sovereign nation. Right. Right. And but what is it? It might not be the lechatchila. It's not the ideal, but it's the reality. And that's what happened. And I think that this may be, you know, while they were certainly not the picture of perfection, they restored Jewish sovereignty and ruled for over a century. And, you know, Rav Kook saw the Hasmonean dynasty as a paradigm for the creation of a modern Jewish sovereign nation on its soil, on her soil in their ancestral homeland, in spite of all their flaws. And the Hashmonaim were flawed. Again, they succumbed to the Hellenism, ultimately, that they tried to fight against. So Rav Kook draws on this period, and he draws on the Hashmonaim, warts and all. And I think that's very significant, because Rav Kook understood that it dafka was going to be the secular Zionists and the Chalutzim, the pioneers, who were going to build the modern state of Israel. Right? And Rav Kook took tremendous criticism from the religious establishment, from the other rabbis in his day, for embracing the secular Zionists and the pioneers, but he saw within them a spark of holiness. And this is consistent with much of Rav Kook's thought. You know, this idea that first we have to build and then we sanctify. It's something that his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, would often repeat, drawing on the Gemara in the Me'ilah. Me'ilah and Daf Yud Dalet, Bonim Bachol, V'achar Kach Mekadshim. First we build, and then we sanctify, right? Joe the plumber is going to be building in the Holy Temple. How can he go there? He's not a Kohen. He's not the Kohen Gadol. He's walking all over wherever he wants. Yeah, first we build it, and then we sanctify it. And Rav Kook believed, this is, I'm quoting from the Ma'amarei HaRaya, in all aspects of life, the secular awakens first, and only afterwards the holy must awaken to complete the resuscitation of the secular. So that is a theme consistent with Rav Kook. So it's so fascinating. He draws on the Hashmonaim, warts and all, with all their problems, usurping the throne, and they were Kohanim, and they desecrated their kahuna, according to the Ramban, and they were punished later, according to the Ramban. But nevertheless, yeah, it's going to be the secular Zionists, the Chalutzim, that are going to build this state. Okay? It's incredible. So in a certain sense, the Hashmonaim are a fitting choice for the modern state of Israel. You know, many question the validity of the modern state of Israel. I believe in Eretz Israel. I don't believe in Medinat Yisrael, right? A state that is founded by secular Zionists who were, many of them, antagonistic to religion. Yet it would seem that, yes, indeed, the Hashmonaim would be a fitting choice. This modern state of Israel, I often refer to it as an Atar Bnia. It's a construction site, not only because wherever you go, there's a construction site, and that's why it takes me so long to get here in the mornings. They're building roads, and it takes them forever, and train lines and things. But this modern state of Israel, it's a work in progress. We're undergoing construction. It's a construction site, not just physically, but spiritually and conceptually. Okay. So while Hanukkah, as we know, was instituted by Chazal as 8 days of Hallel v'Hoda'ah, giving praise and thanks to Hashem, I think we too can reflect on how fortunate we are to have a Jewish state, warts and all, with all of its problems, this Atar B'niyah, this construction site, which is very much a work in progress, but we too have to give Hakarat HaTov, have to give Hallel v'Hoda'ah. And during these 8 days of Hanukkah, we can reflect on how fortunate we are and say, yes, okay, things are far from perfect nowadays, but look back during the period of the Chashmonaim, during the Hanukkah story, which we celebrate and we sing, and we've got the candles and the dreidels and the sufganiyot and the latkes. Well, we recognize that even back then, things were far from being a picture of perfection. But Baruch Hashem, Ashrei Ayin Ratazot, fortunate is the eye who has seen all this. We've returned to our land after 2,000 years and been fortunate to build a state, and we've come home. And so we have to say Hallel and Hoda'ah. I wish you all a Chanukah Sameach. We will be meeting Be'ezrat Hashem. We will be meeting Wednesday morning of Chanukah. Feel free to bring some latkes and sufganiyot. I'm trying to lose weight, so I won't be eating them. But have a wonderful... I said I'm not going to be eating. Have a wonderful day, a wonderful week, and a Freilichen Chanukah. A lichtige Chanukah.